Hello, it is Wednesday, the 24th of June. Welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Andrew Jung. The UN's International Maritime Organization said around 11,000 sailors stranded in the Strait of Hormuz will be evacuated in a large-scale operation. That comes as four South Korean vessels were reported to be on their way home. More on that shortly. During our in-depth segment, we will discuss Trump's latest outreach to North Korea and South Korean President Lee Jae-myung's conversations with the Pope and what that could mean for the Korean Peninsula. Plus, author Sylvia Park joins us to talk about an international book fair in Seoul and how writers should approach their craft in a world dominated by artificial intelligence. Korea 24 starts now.
I also want to flag an initiative on the Strait of Hormuz from our colleagues at the International Maritime Organization, who tell us they will be beginning implementing an evacuation plan for more than 11,000 seafarers who remain stranded in the region. The large-scale operation will be carried out in close cooperation with Iran, Oman, and all other coastal states in the region.
That was Stephane Dujarric, the spokesperson for the UN Secretary General, explaining that the International Maritime Organization has announced a large-scale evacuation plan for the more than 11,000 crew stranded in the Strait of Hormuz. Among them are 108 South Korean sailors. For more on the relocation plan and other major headlines of the day, we have in the studio with us Deputy Editor-in-Chief of KBS World's English News Service, Kim In-kyung. Hello, In-kyung.
Hello, Andrew.
The Strait of Hormuz has ostensibly reopened since the United States and Iran signed an interim deal last week to end the war. But more than 10,000 sailors remain stranded in the waterway. In-kyung, can you tell us more about the IMO's plan to evacuate them?
Sure. The IMO, which is a UN body, said Tuesday that it plans to safely relocate the sailors through close consultation with Oman and other coastal states in the region. The operation has the backing of both Iran and the United States. The IMO says it has secured the necessary safety guarantees and thoroughly verified the conditions for safe navigation to facilitate operations. The evacuation plan comes nearly a week after the U.S. and Iran signed a memorandum of understanding to reopen the straits. While ship traffic has increased since the MOU was signed, it remains significantly lower than pre-war levels. Let's take another listen to Dujarric taking questions from the press.
If the Strait of Hormuz is open, why do they need to be evacuated, number one? And number two is, are they just going to be evacuated off the ships that they're presumably stranded on, or are they? Is the operation to repatriate them to their countries?
Part of it is ensuring, we've seen the statements about the state of the strait, but it's also ensuring that the ships that do leave do it safely.
Oman's Navy also issued a bulletin confirming that ships will be evacuated in phases through two temporary maritime corridors to ensure the safety of the seafarers.
Over a dozen South Korean ships are also stranded in the strait, but four more have exited the waterway. In-kyung, can you give us the details?
Four more South Korean vessels have left the strait for a total of six since the U.S. and Iran's MOU to end the war. Seoul's Ministry of Oceans and Fisheries said Wednesday that they have passed through the waterway and are now navigating normally. 26 South Korean crew members are aboard the ships. The ministry said one of the vessels is a tanker carrying 2 million barrels of crude oil and is expected to arrive in Yeosu, South Jeolla province around the middle of next month. The other three are bound for third countries. South Korean shipping and logistics company HMM confirmed that the oil tanker bound for Yeosu is the Universal Glory, while one of the other three vessels is the HMM Daon container ship headed for Oman. Now, 18 South Korea-linked ships remain in the straits, as well as 108 South Korean sailors, 33 of whom are on foreign vessels.
In other headlines, the South Korean military says it has taken into custody a North Korean soldier who crossed the military demarcation line in the Central Front area on Tuesday night. In-kyung, what can you tell us?
The Joint Chiefs of Staff said Wednesday that details are currently under investigation by relevant authorities. The North Korean soldier has reportedly expressed an intention to defect. This marks the fourth defection case since the start of the Lee Jae-myung administration and the second involving a North Korean soldier. In October last year, another North Korean soldier crossed the MDL in the Central Front and expressed a desire to defect, after which South Korean forces took the soldier into custody and handed the case over to relevant agencies. Separately, a civilian man man crossed the MDL in the Midwestern Front on July 3rd of last year, and another civilian man was rescued later the same month in the neutral zone of the Han River estuary located west of the inter-Korean land border.
In political news, ruling Democratic Party leader Jeong Chung-rae has resigned, likely to seek re-election when the party holds a national convention on August 17th. Politicians usually seek re-election. Why is this such a big news that Chung is likely to run again?
Well, Chung is expected to compete against Prime Minister Kim Min-seok and former DP chair Song Yong-gil in a three-way race for the two-year chairmanship. South Korean presidents usually don't explicitly endorse candidates, but President Lee has been quite clear about who he'd like to win. As we talked about earlier, the presidential office asked Chung not to come to Lee's send-off ceremony before leaving for Europe. He also showered Prime Minister Kim with lavish praise during his recent one-year-in-office press conference. The next leader of the party is really important because he or she will have tremendous sway over nominating candidates to the general elections, which is 2 years away. At a Supreme Council meeting on Wednesday, Chung said he has decided to step down after sleepless nights of self-reflection and looking back on his political career. Party floor leader Han Byung-do is expected to serve as the acting chief until the party convention.
Moving on, the Ministry of Data and Statistics has released the number of births for April, and it's on a steady rise. In-young, can you tell us on the details?
Yes, the number of births jumped 18% year-on-year in April. That represents the fastest growth for the month since the compilation of relevant statistics began in 1981. 24,521 babies were born in April, the highest figure for the month in 7 years. The total fertility rate, which is the average number of children born to a woman over her lifetime, also rose 0.13 from the previous year to 0.93 and remained above 0.9 for the fourth straight month. The rebound is attributed to the growing population of women in their early 30s and an increase in the number of marriages. A total of 20,622 couples tied the knot in April, up 9%, which is the sixth largest count for the month on record.
Finally, South Korea's match against South Africa is less than 24 hours away. It kicks off at 7 p.m. Wednesday in Mexico or 10 a.m. Thursday, Korea Standard Time. Head coach Hong Myung-bo held a pre-match press conference at the Monterrey Stadium in Guadalupe, Mexico. What did he say?
South Korea will advance to the round of 32 in second place, even with a draw against South Africa. But Hong said South Korea will play to win. Here's what he said.
일단은 지금의 상황은 저희 팀한테는 나쁘지는 않지만 그렇다고 뭔가
The current situation for our team isn't bad, but I don't think it's particularly helpful either. Since this type of match is difficult to play and the opponent is very tough, if we start thinking a draw will be good enough, we are going to be in trouble. We will not give up and will prepare for the match with the mindset that we will win until the very end.
포기하지 않고 끝까지 꼭 승리
Kim Min-jae, the core of the national team's defense, joined Hong at the press conference. Here's the clip.
The South African players have good technical skills. They have speed, and our defenders have talked about preparing well in these areas. And as a team, if we play like we did in the past two games, I think we can win.
South Korea came from behind to win 2-1 against Czechia in their first group match, but suffered a 0-1 defeat to co-host Mexico in their second match due to a defensive error. That's it for today's news briefing. Thank you, In-young.
Thank you, Andrew.
Truth is, I am Iron Man.
Annyeong, Korea. This is Bob Layton, co-creator of Iron Man. You are listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
While the United States and Iran are working to end their months-long war, U.S. President Donald Trump has told South Korean President Lee Jae-myung that it's time to pay attention to North Korea. Trump made the remark during his meeting with Lee on the sidelines of last week's Group of Seven summit in France, according to the South Korean leader. Then hours after announcing the U.S.-Iran peace agreement, Trump posted a photo taken during his 2018 summit with North Korea's Kim Jong-un. Amid signs of a shift in Washington's focus, President Lee met Pope Leo XIV at the Vatican last week and asked the pontiff to visit North Korea. But Pyongyang is doubling down on its nuclear ambitions. Kim is pushing to increase his country's nuclear and conventional arsenal with the goal of, quote, overtaking the world. To get expert views and analysis on these issues, we are joined on the line by two guests. First, we have Mr. Troy Stangarone, non-resident fellow with the Carnegie Mellon Institute for Strategy and Technology. Hello, Mr. Stangarone.
Hi, Andrew. It's good to be here.
We also have Andrew Yeh, Director of Asian Studies at the Catholic University of America. He's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution's Center for Asia Policy Studies. Hello, Dr. Yeh.
Hi, great to join you and Troy.
Mr. Stangarone, I wanted to start with the photograph that Trump posted from his first summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un 8 years ago. Trump uploaded the photo to his Truth Social account without any accompanying comment. The image was taken during the first U.S.-North Korea summit held in Singapore in June 2018, showing Trump and Kim walking together in the gardens of the Capella Hotel, the venue of that historic meeting. Shortly before posting the photo, Trump wrote that a peace agreement with Iran would be signed. What did you make of the photo and the post and the timing of all this? What could be Trump's intentions?
It's been clear for quite a while that President Trump wants to try to revive talks with North Korea. If we go back last year, prior to the APEC summit, you know, President Trump continuously said, you know, he would be in Asia, he'd be willing to meet Kim Jong-un. He often talked about how he felt Kim Jong-un missed seeing him. So I think President Trump on this issue has been very transparent that he wants to try and meet Kim Jong-un again at some point. In terms of the timing, if we look at the war, you know, this has been a complete policy failure for President Trump. You know, there are bipartisan concerns about what we think may be a deal, but is only really a memorandum of understanding. There are concerns that this deal has actually left Iran in a better position potentially than it was before the war started, and that the deal might not even be as good as what President Barack Obama got. And so if we think about this in this context, basically President Trump is trying to do what President Trump has always done, which is to try to change the subject. And so I think he really wants to move on from this war and try to move into something that he thinks might be more productive for him and give him better press, which is to take and try to restart things with North Korea. So move past this Iran debacle and try to move into the next thing is essentially what we're seeing.
President Lee Jae-myung and Trump spoke several times on the sidelines of last week's Group of Seven summit in France. According to President Lee, Trump told him that it was, quote, time to pay attention to North Korea. Possibly reflecting what Mr. Stangarone just mentioned. Lee also said he advised Trump that the North Korean nuclear issue should be approached in a different way from the nuclear situations of other countries. Instead, Lee proposed a phased approach to the North Korean nuclear issue involving first halting the country's production of nuclear materials and shipping existing nuclear materials overseas before pursuing long-term denuclearization. In response to this proposal, Trump said that could be one way to approach the issue and said that he would need to think about it. Dr. Yeh, how do you view this proposal, and do you think Trump will pursue this?
Sure. Well, thanks for that question. And in terms of the proposal, I mean, Trump really doesn't know any of the details about how negotiations would unfold, but I think he just threw this. You know, I think Lee is seen as, in some ways, the Trump whisperer when it comes to getting Trump to think about Korea peace. Remember, he said he would be the pacemaker to Trump being the peacemaker. And so this is Lee's way of trying to re-up some kind of strategy or game plan to Trump that maybe he can pass on to his team at the White House at the statement. The problem with the proposal, though, is that I think it will... It won't really go anywhere because you still have denuclearization at the end of the day. And we know that Kim Jong-un said that he would not engage with the U.S., he wouldn't meet the U.S. unless they dropped denuclearization. So Trump could try to propose it. He could float it to his team back, those that are responsible for North Korea diplomacy, but I'm not sure if it would get anywhere.
Well, we've heard that type of proposal before, almost a decade ago. But Lee also noted that Trump expressed regret for not taking more effective action regarding the North Korean nuclear issue before the country successfully developed nuclear weapons. And Trump appeared concerned about the absence of a proper solution to the issue, perhaps as what Dr. Ye just mentioned. What options are there for Trump to consider, Mr. Sangarone, and in terms of denuclearization of North Korea?
Well, I think, when we look at what President Trump has in terms of options, he likes to talk in terms of poker and who has the cards. And in this situation, President Trump doesn't have the cards. It's North Korea that does. And so when we look at what's happened, even just this year, the Venezuela option isn't really an option with North Korea. Not only is North Korea better prepared to protect its leader than Venezuela was, but it's unlikely you would have anyone, because most likely in Venezuela, they turn to someone to make that operation successful. There would also be significantly more military risks. You'd have significant diplomatic fallout. I imagine China would not stay on the sidelines if such a thing were to happen. So that's just not really an option. If you look then at any type of military strikes, again, that's not really an option in the absence of absolutely clear evidence that North Korea was about to attack. So that means you only have diplomacy. And on the diplomacy side, the reason why Kim Jong-un hasn't met with President Trump is, in essence, he holds all the cards. He has a new partnership with Russia that is taking and bringing both economic and tactical and military benefits. We've seen the relationship with China is improving as well. So that takes and places him in a position to where he doesn't necessarily need the United States right now. And because Russia is violating most, if not all, UN sanctions, you're in a position to where there is no leverage over North Korea. Hmm. So President Trump can engage in diplomacy, but he has to significantly scale back his ambitions. And this is part of what Andrew was talking about. If denuclearization is on the table, it's not clear that the North Koreans would even want to talk, let alone that President Trump has the leverage he needs to get there.
So not only does Kim Jong-un hold all the cards, he is in no rush. Dr. Ye, President Lee Jae-myung was also at the Vatican, where he asked the Pope, Pope Leo XIV, to visit North Korea. The president asked the Pope to visit South Korea as well on the occasion of the World Youth Congress slated for next year in Seoul, and said that he also requested that the pontiff, quote, push for a visit to North Korea if possible. According to the South Korean president, the Pope said that he would actively consider the invitation. What role could the Pope play in diplomacy and in this part of the world?
Historically, the Vatican approaches geopolitics and diplomacy differently from states. Often they separate people from politics, prioritizing humanitarian assistance. So in the Korean Peninsula, this would mean issues like reuniting families that have been divided. It also means talking about denuclearization. The Vatican likes to leverage its moral standing, its global pulpit to influence public opinion. And it also has to take a strict neutral role. So it doesn't pick sides between North or South Korea. So using having that kind of diplomatic standing and taking a neutral approach, I think President Lee believes that the Vatican may be able to suggest or perhaps create an environment or atmosphere that might be more conducive for diplomacy. But of course, the past popes such as Pope Francis had weighed in on Korean peace. Francis had also said that he would be open to traveling to North Korea, which was different because in the past, I think there was some reluctance unless North Korea addresses issues like human rights. But I think Francis was open to it, but it never really took place. But Lee is, again, using the occasion of this World Youth Day to see if maybe Pope Leo might come to South Korea and then maybe come to the DMZ and create an opportunity for diplomacy with North Korea.
Well, why do you think President Lee made that request? How likely do you think it is that the Pope will visit North Korea? What issues are at stake? I know that you mentioned some of them, but could you tell us more?
Yeah, Lee, President Lee seems very keen and trying to get engagement to work on any front. He knows that South Korea is not going to get any meeting with Kim Jong-un, but if Kim meets Trump or if Kim meets the Pope, perhaps that can create some kind of energy that allows South Korea to partake in some kind of diplomatic engagement with North Korea. So in some ways, it's a backdoor way for South Korea to become reintegrated with or to be reengaged with North Korea when it comes to diplomacy. In terms of the likelihood of that happening, I mean, it's hard to say because for the most part, North Korea has ignored, you know, papal statements on Korean peace. I also think that, you know, there might be some questions about Pope Leo coming, especially if Pope Leo is an American, and you know, they might say he might believe that the Vatican may be partial to the West, and so why would we have someone from, you know, the enemy, hostile country coming to visit? So I am a bit skeptical. But then again, you know, for Kim Jong-un, if there is some kind of diplomacy that were to restart with the U.S., you know, we've seen certainly diplomacy on the uptick when it comes to authoritarian countries like Russia, China, Belarus, that maybe Kim Jong-un might be open to also meeting the Vatican if it were to elevate his own standing and legitimacy, both abroad and at home.
Mr. Stangaro, do you think that the Pope will visit North Korea, and what role could he play if he does come visit?
Well, I think Andrew has laid this out fairly well. But one thing I want to add is another role that the Vatican historically played is back channel negotiations to try and take and help each side bridge differences. And, you know, recently, with Andrew had mentioned, you know, Pope Francis in North Korea, but the opening between the Obama administration and Cuba was facilitated partially by back channel negotiations run through the Vatican. And so I think in some question of whether the Pope visits North Korea might be immaterial in the sense that, you know, there's reasons why Kim Jong-un may find that appealing, but there's also reasons why he may not. But North Korea may be more open to back channel discussions through the Vatican that seek to address or bring some common understanding between the United States, South Korea, and it. Now, clearly, that's probably not going to include denuclearization, and maybe the Vatican takes the perspective of, well, starting with issues to where there can be some common ground and hope that you can build more common ground over time. But I think, you know, this is where the Vatican might play a more prominent role, even if perhaps it's less publicly known.
While North Korea continues to expand its nuclear arsenal, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has called for efforts to further increase his country's nuclear assets, quote, with a goal of overtaking the world. According to the North state-run Korean Central News Agency on Tuesday, regime leader Kim Jong-un made such remarks during the second plenary meeting of the ruling Workers' Party's 9th Central Committee. What does North Korea mean when it says, quote, overtaking the world? We're obviously aware that North Korean propaganda and state media does engage in these types of arguments. But what do you read into North Korea's plans, if you will, to expand its nuclear arsenal, Mr. Stangaro?
In the context of North Korea, I take this statement to mean that they want the nuclear program to be a fiat accompli. This is something the North Koreans have been trying to do for a long time. But from their perspective, if you get to a point to where they have demonstrated capabilities, they have a robust arsenal in terms of both warheads and delivery systems, then, in essence, the world can say it wants to roll back North Korea's nuclear program, but it becomes a reality that the world has to deal with. And so this is what I think Kim Jong-un really means, is that he wants to reach a point. Clearly, this suggests he doesn't believe he's there yet, but that he wants to go to a point to where there is nothing the world can do to take and roll this situation back. You know, be it either militarily because it would be too risky, be it diplomatically because the cost would be too great. And the regime itself has already been very clear it's not going to do that. So I think in this broader context, that's what Kim Jong-un and North Korea mean by that.
Dr. Ye, the KCNA readout also noted that Pyongyang restated its policy designating South Korea as, quote, the most hostile state, and criticized Seoul and Washington's military alliance, including their nuclear consultative group on nuclear deterrence and Seoul's push to build its own nuclear submarines. What did you read into the statement about, quote, overtaking the world, and what does that mean for inter-Korean relations?
Similar to what Troy had mentioned, I mean, I think this idea of overtaking the world isn't literally like they're going to become the world's superpower and overtake everything, but it points to their nuclear weapon that North Korea is a nuclear power, and it's not going to give up its nuclear weapons. And because of South Korea's own military alliance with the U.S., because it's pursuing nuclear-powered submarines, that North Korea has the license and the freedom to be able to explore its own nuclear options. And so that's what I think it means by overtaking the world. And of course, this has dire implications for inter-Korea relations. And that's why I think it's really interesting about President Lee Jae-myung, because on one hand, he's pushing engagement with North Korea. But on the other hand, there are these signals that suggest that North Korea is less and less enamored to the idea of any sort of engagement with a hostile foreign state like South Korea. So there's a bit of a disconnect there between what the North Koreans are saying and what Lee Jae-myung hopes to do in terms of jumpstarting inter-Korea relations.
As a final thought, what issues should we watch out for from here on out? Do you think the U.S.-North Korea summit could happen, if that is even a possibility?
I actually do think it can happen. I've been on the record saying this. I mean, we haven't seen it yet, but partly because President Trump clearly is fixated on the idea of meeting Kim. The first question you asked Troy about the photograph or the photo that he posted on Truth Social with him and Kim Jong-un, I mean, it repeats the February Oval Office visit of the South Korean Prime Minister, where in the middle of their discussion on North Korea, he asked one of the White House staff to bring a photo of himself and Kim Jong-un. I mean, who does that unless you're constantly thinking about this leader? So clearly he wants to meet. The signal is there. The ball is in really North Korea's court. As I've said, if North Korea wants to normalize relations with the United States or move towards a better relationship, its best shot of doing so is under President Trump. And so they have 2.5 years to do it. So I do think a meeting will happen. Whether it can happen this year, is it something that we should watch out for? I think anything is really in the cards. I think if Kim shows signs finally that he's ready to meet, I think steps can move fairly quickly. Many believe that we might have to wait until after the midterm election. That Trump and his team can be prepared for a high stakes summit meeting, round three, or maybe round four with Kim Jong-un. But I do think we should be paying attention to this, the possibility of a Trump-Kim meeting this year.
Mr. Stangarone, I know you mentioned that Trump is eager to shift the narrative from Iran. How does that play into your predictions about a potential summit? And do you think that will happen this year or possibly next?
I think Andrew's right. It'll depend on when the North Koreans want to meet. I think if Kim Jong-un said he would meet in a month, Trump would find a way to get there. I mean, Trump has been that forward about his desire to meet with Kim Jong-un. But when we look at this, it really boils down to a couple things. One, and this is true of any U.S. president, there are authoritarian leaders that they get along with and there are authoritarian leaders they don't. For the case of North Korea, Kim Jong-un is someone who President Trump clearly believes he gets along with. And I think it would be in Kim Jong-un's interest to find a way this year to meet with President Trump. Because I think the more President Trump keeps suggesting he wants to meet, the more Kim Jong-un puts it off, the more he risks President Trump taking a negative view of him. So there is this balance put into play. And you know, within that broader context, you know, I think what we want to watch for is how these negotiations, if we get there, and I sort of suspect this may be more what I refer to as a coffee meeting, kind of like, hi, it's great to see you. let's talk about talking. But, you know, I think we could see a significant shift in the way both sides approach these talks going forward. You know, Kim Jong-un was burned by not doing any pre-negotiations and agreeing to things and trying to leave everything to the Hanoi summit. Mm. And I don't think he's going to want to go through that again if he wants to do any kind of deal with President Trump. But what we've seen from President Trump in his second term, be it either the trade deals, be it, you know, this MOU with Iran and other things, is that one, the administration tends to not be prepared. It tends to look for quick victories. It tends to put in vague language and push negotiations further off. And so I think, in essence, some of the things you saw the North Koreans do the first time around, you might see the U.S. do this time. And so in some strange way, we might see the negotiating strategies of the two sides shift. And I think that's one of the things we should be looking for.
Mm. The lesson that I'm drawing is anything is possible under Trump. But that's all for today's in-depth news analysis. We had Mr. Troy Stangerone, non-resident fellow with the Carnegie Mellon Institute for Strategy and Technology. Thank you, Mr. Stangerone.
Thank you.
And we also had Andrew Ye, Director of Asian Studies at the Catholic University of America. Thank you, Dr. Ye.
Thank you. Thanks for having us here.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 267.18 points, or 3.26% on Wednesday, to close at 8,471.02. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ gained 17.79 points, or 2%, to close at 909.31. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets and handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Andrew.
So, what's our first story?
The South Korean government issues so-called meal cards for children of low-income or single-parent families and other individuals under the age of 18 in need of such support. Unfortunately, recent findings show cases of misusing the card added up to some 1.2 billion won, or around $770,000 last year alone.
So before we talk about this potential waste, tell us what the meal cards are for in the first place.
Well, the goal is to ensure the group in need won't have to skip meals. The cards can be used just like debit cards to pay for food at restaurants, bakeries, and convenience stores. The meal card is loaded with about 300,000 won each month, and around 150,000 children use the meal card.
Okay, then. So how do you misuse these meal cards? Any examples?
So based on the joint inspection conducted by the Office for Government Policy Coordination and the Welfare Ministry between November and April, there were many cases of parents using the cards to buy non-food items, including cigarettes and alcohol. Some parents were even found to have made false payments at restaurants they run.
So it's not the kids who are at fault, it seems, at least from these examples. But it sounds like there are a lot of loopholes. Is that right?
Right. Well, most convenience stores have a system denying payments with meal cards for various restricted items. Many other establishments, including smaller stores, do not have such a system yet. There were cases of abusive parents separated from their children taking advantage of the card, and some parents continued to use the card even after their children passed away.
Then I guess I have to ask, what measures are being taken to prevent further misuse?
Kim Yong-soo, the first vice minister for government policy coordination, acknowledged that most local governments focus more on issuing the cards and they fell short of making sure they are used as intended. With new local governments taking office, they plan to thoroughly review the entire meal card system. Officials said some of the measures being reviewed include expanding the installation of payment denial systems and also toughening punishment of businesses cooperating with attempts to abuse the cards.
Such a shameless act committed by those parents, I have to say. But let's move on to our next story.
Foraging for species of small freshwater snails known commonly as tasilgi, that's used as an ingredient for various cuisines in Korea, is quite a popular activity during the summer season. However, there's been a rising number of deadly accidents linked to tasilgi foraging.
Tasilgi is that clam-like ingredient that goes into Korean food, and it's certainly not an unfamiliar food ingredient here in Korea. But how many people have died?
Well, according to the Ministry of the Interior and Safety on Wednesday, over the past three summers, 32 people have died while foraging for tasilgi in rivers and valleys, and the annual death toll has been rising yearly, 7 recorded in 2023, 11 in 2024, 14 last year.
But I'm still left wondering, did they eat the tasilgi raw? Why the death?
Well, it actually happened during the process of foraging, not consumption, thankfully. The activity involves one wading into shallow riverbeds and valley streams where the terrain is often uneven and slippery. Fatal accidents linked to tasilgi foraging saw steepest rise in August, which is the peak of summer, mainly because water levels can rise suddenly during this month due to upstream rainfall, catching foragers off guard.
So a friendly reminder to any of our listeners thinking about taking a dip in the water, be aware of the risks that may be involved, including drowning and slipping. But any tips on how to avoid the dangers when going tasilgi hunting?
So more than 80% of such deadly incidents involve people in their 60s and older. So the ministry has distributed safety guidelines targeting this group. Key tips include refraining from foraging after drinking or during nighttime or when it gets too dark. And when going out to forage for tasilgi, be sure to never do it alone and wear a life jacket or life vest.
So don't drink and drive and don't drink and dip. But moving on to our final story, what do you have, Dan?
A recent study shows more than 98% of surveyed parents in South Korea support restricting smartphone use by minors.
I'm a social media skeptic, and I can see why parents might think that way. But what were some of the reasons that parents are concerned about giving their children full access to these devices?
The findings released by the National Assembly Education Committee on Wednesday shows the results of a survey conducted on more than 52,000 parents of elementary, middle, and high school students in Seoul, Incheon, and South Gyeongsang Province. And the main reason the parents felt the need for such restriction was nearly 98% said smartphones could increase exposure to harmful content or inappropriate information.
That's certainly a valid concern. But how exposed are young children to smartphones and social media in Korea?
So a separate 2023 survey by the Korea Press Foundation shows nearly 30% of children first used a smartphone before the age of 24 months. More than 70% had done so before the age of 5.
Again, I'm a skeptic when it comes to social media, but we've talked about this on our show before. It might not be practical to limit access to electronics or social media devices in this day and age. And yes, social media isn't always harmful. They do provide valid benefits. So what did the parents say about this high exposure?
Well, the surveyed parents said they are aware of the risks of smartphones and they still feel compelled to give them to their children, though, due to concerns about safety and school life. They stressed the need to introduce safe phones that retain essential functions while restricting access to harmful features.
So what's the plan? Did the National Assembly Committee that you mentioned say anything about all this?
Yes, the committee announced plans to hold in-depth discussion sessions based on the survey result and related findings. Educational officials, teachers, parents, and students from 17 cities and provinces will be participating in it. Together, the attendees will help review the feasibility of such safe smart devices and related systems and also policies.
Hoping those conversations aren't just talks for talks, but that's all we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm pianist Kevin Chen, and you are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
2026 Seoul International Book Fair kicked off at COEX in Gangnam, Seoul, one of Asia's largest publishing industry events. It brings together creatives and critics alike to celebrate the written word. This year's theme is Homo Duduri, drawing on the mythical Korean Duduri, a goblin blacksmith who faces fire rather than fleeing it, as a metaphor for the wisdom humanity needs in order to confront the unavoidable blades of AI, which now writes and creates at will. So what does the introduction of AI mean, not only for writers and readers, but for mankind? To seek more clarity on today's Korea Book Club, instead of asking a book critic to review translated works of Korean literature like we usually do, we turn to Korean-American author Sylvia Park, an invited guest at the fair. As the author of an English science fiction work titled Luminous, released last year to broad appeal, Ms. Park is participating in the book festival to talk about the science fiction genre, robots, and technology. We are honored to host the author today in our studio. Welcome, Sylvia.
It is a pleasure to be here.
It's day one of the Seoul International Book Fair. The festival's theme, Homo Duduri, asks us to reflect on the relationship between human and artificial intelligence. I'd like to get your thoughts on that theme. Specifically, what does it mean to be a writer in the age of AI? And what does it mean to gather for a book fair in this age of AI?
So one thing I saw actually just recently on SNS was all those crowds right now at the book fair. And I'm happy to be here, to be away from those crowds. But at the same time, I'm also just really gratified to see so many people excited about books, because I think I have a lot of students who come to me and ask, how do we write in the age of AI? And there's a lot of fears. I think there's a lot of genuine, very legitimate fears about how can we compete? How can we compete, especially if AI is now being posed as this thing that's going to replace us? That's not just replacing us in terms of workers, but replacing us creatively. But what I usually tell my students is that we shouldn't really be afraid of AI replacing us. I think what we should fear more is letting AI think instead of us. And that's really my concern with AI, because if you think that AI writes better than you, then essentially what you really think is not that AI is writing better, but AI is writing faster. That AI is more efficient, AI is just easier to use, and it makes you start to think that writing is easy, that thinking is easy. And I have to say, writing is very, very hard. A lot of authors easily spend years just working on a book, and a book that might not even see the light of day. So that's really my concern, is that we can't let ourselves think that AI can do these things. AI may be able to help us, it may be able to amplify us or support us, but really the concern is not ceding all control and creativity to AI.
Your book actually addresses this role of the non-human directly through a variety of characters that includes humans, but also a beloved family robot. Tell us more about Luminous and also how the theme relates to your book.
Yeah, so I started writing this book during the pandemic, which is why I wasn't really anticipating that AI would really explode in our consciousness. So in fact, when I was working on the novel, I was pretty prepared to talk about the AI in fiction should be kept separate as AI in reality, because AI in reality at that time was pretty feeble. But now AI has really suffused our society. And what I want to now say is that actually this book has become scarily a little bit much closer to home, particularly because when I try to describe this book, I have to describe it as like Frankenstein's monster, because the spine is sort of like a police procedural. The flesh is science fiction, but the beating heart is really a family drama. The book is about a pair of estranged siblings. They haven't talked to each other in years, and they haven't talked to each other in that long because they lost a brother when they were still very young, and that brother was actually a robot. So the book is really interested in asking questions about what happens when we let robots, when we let AI, not just, you know, replace us in terms of labor, but replace us in terms of emotional labor. We're inviting them in to our family, into our home. And you know, I think it's quite funny that right now, you know, the new Toy Story movie is just out. And as always, they're trying to capture a parental fear. And apparently the fear is what happens when we raise children with screens. But really now the next step is going to be what happens when you raise children with AI? What happens when we raise children with robots? And that's really the crux of the novel. It's looking at these characters who have now grown up as adults, and they're still grappling with what happened in their childhood, how they loved a robot as family. But one character in particular is just so unsure whether that robot reciprocated that love.
It sounds like almost that AI has added this extra layer of complexity to the human existence almost. It adds this, you know, emotional drama to the, you know, already existing drama. Is that a fair, rough understanding?
Yeah, I think that what's kind of scary about technology is as technology, you know, as we look at the TV show Black Mirror, Black Mirror is not just a reference to the fact that we're looking at a blank TV screen, but it's a mirror of ourselves. And in fact, that show is interested in exploring the darkest, the blackest aspects of ourselves.
Very profound. But you grew up in both the U.S. and South Korea, both countries that are leaders in technological development and the rapid change that accompany it. How does this bicultural experience influence your writing? I know this book touches on, of course, Korea. That's the background. But specifically, how does that affect your work as a science fiction author?
Yeah, so I grew up in Seoul in New York, and I think what's really interesting is that the two cities are really, really similar. Like, it's much bigger of a culture shock to move from, say, New York to Kansas than it is to move from New York to Seoul, because the two cities are very fast-paced, very dense, huge, huge population density, and at the same time, exciting city, competitive, cutthroat. Though Seoul has a way better metro system. But I would say that another big difference, though, is that for me, when I look at Korea's sort of rapid pace, I think it really comes from historical trauma. Because when we look at New York has gone through its share of trauma. Like when we look at 9/11, the pandemic more recently. But really, Korea is a country that was almost destroyed. Japanese colonization really almost wiped it out. It was always a country that where the existence of it was precarious because it grew up sort of sandwiched between two superpowers, China and Japan. So it understands how easy it is for a nation to be wiped out. And that's why I think the way we approach science fiction is a little bit different from the way Western literature approaches science fiction. Because Western literature often embraces dystopia, apocalypse, end of the world as this really dire, awful thing. But I feel like with Korea, with a lot of Asian science fiction, we're interested in really finding the resilience despite this threat of complete destruction. And that's why I think there's that famous Korean saying, you know, 하늘이 무너져도 소산할 구멍이 찾는다. So we always find a way to escape. We understand that there are so many things out of our control. And so that's why I feel the science fiction that comes out of Korea is less about end of the world stakes, more interested in how can we adapt as quickly as possible to a world that we have no control over.
So, Sylvia, you were referring to the Korean saying of even if the sky falls, you can there's an escape, you know, out of this chaos. But speaking of your connection to Korea, the world you built in Luminous is a unified Korea. It's not two Koreas, it's just one Korea. There is a reunification war. Tell us more about that particular setting and why you decided to talk about a unified Korea.
Yeah, so that setting actually came last in terms of, I think a lot of people, when they ask about the world, they think that it came first. But originally, the book was set like pretty far in the future. I guess this is me being optimistic about how far away AI is. But I set it sort of in a vague, like pan-Asia situation. But then when I looked at, you know, when you want to write about the future, you're really writing about the present and the past. And so looking at Korea's history, I just felt that it was a bit disrespectful to write about a future where Korea didn't exist, where it was just absorbed into this like gigantic Asian country. So that was really my effort to correct that impulse of to respect and preserve Korea's resilience of wanting, of making sure it exists. And so when I decided to respect that and include Korea in the future, the natural next step was to ask, then what happened to North Korea? And as a result of that, this only came to me in retrospect, but I realized that the book, as I said before, it's about, you know, two siblings who lost a brother. They don't know what happened to him. And really, when I think about it, the setting is an echo of that. It's our country that is divided from North Korea. North Korea is something like a ghost. Hmm. It's not dead. It's not gone. But it's so out of reach that it continues to haunt us from across the border.
That's a very nice, you know, description of the emotional trauma involved in that particular chapter of history. But we also want to discuss the book fair. So coming back to the book fair, you've talked... Your talks have scheduled with the Korean sci-fi writer Kim Choi-up. In our past Korea Book Club segments, we've dealt with not only Kim's works, but also many other translated Korean science fiction novels. There seems to be a surge of popularity in the genre recently. Can you give us a sneak peek of your scheduled talk at the fair? And also, what do you read into this popularity of sci-fi novels?
I think that, first of all, the book fair talk is going to be great. It's going to be very intense. Mm. The questions are really, it really digs deep into both our works. And our works are very, very different. The critic also, the moderator noted that, but also was surprised by the surprising overlaps between these two very different books that are different in terms of tone and also in terms of like thickness. But I think that the reason why science fiction, particularly Korean science fiction, has really hit a stride is because, again, we are not, Korean science fiction is less interested in really kind of encapsulating genre the way I feel like Western science fiction really went in a dystopian direction. Hmm. Korean science fiction is more interested in balance and in, you know, in balancing, but also in adapting to what might seem like changes that are out of our control. So that's why I find Korean science fiction to be a lot, I find it to be really heartrending. And that's one thing that I think is really remarkable about Kim Choi-ok's work, mm. is that her works are so deeply philosophical and scientific, but also deeply, deeply humane. It's full of humanity, it's full of heart. And that's why taking sort of this, all these, you know, the background and the questions about science fiction, when you clear all that away, the questions that really remain with us are questions about the heart, questions about family, questions about how do we still love despite the world trying to dehumanize us.
We were talking about this before the show. It has echoes of Pachinko, right? The parallels between history, the trauma, the family division, all of that. So it sounds very interesting. But what is the one message that you'd like to leave your audience with at this fair?
Please buy a lot of books.
Oh, okay. Simple enough. Luminous, your book, swept up awards upon its release, including the Sci-Fi Famous Otherwise Award and the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. It was also shortlisted for the Arthur C. Clarke Award and a finalist for the Locus Award. After this success, what is next for you as a writer? Is there a possible adaptation of Luminous coming our way, or even a new book in the works? What's coming up?
Well, the adaptation rights for Luminous actually sold before the book sold to a publisher.
Huh.
Which is pretty great because I keep getting paid for it.
Oh, okay.
That was quite a while back.
Okay.
But the thing about Hollywood is that you just never know. You never know what really gets made. I spoke to a really fantastic, incredible, living legend sci-fi writer, say, Che Chang. And he told me about his adaptations and how they just kind of died, mm. you know, without just sort of, you know, without any input from him. And so after I heard that, I thought, okay, yeah, you never know what happens with an adaptation. But if an adaptation is made, it would be really wonderful to see, particularly, I think, our country on the screen. And that's really why when I did sign with the production studio, it's because they said they made Pachinko. They have all these already existing ties with Korean production studios. And so they were very interested, very committed to recreating that show in Korea itself. But that's what's happening right now, at least all I know about the adaptation. Aside from that, I'm just writing. I'm writing on a new book.
I'm just so jealous, you know, as a reporter journalist. But that's it for today's special interview with Korean-American writer, author Sylvia Park. It was an honor having you here.
It was great to have you here, too.
And this is where we wrap up our show for today. Again, you can always listen to Korea 24 on various apps, KBS Kong, KBS World Radio, KBS World Radio On Air at 7:10 p.m. Korea Standard Time every weekday. We'll be back tomorrow. I've been your host, Andrew Jung. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.